Ohio seniors, it's time to make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Plans start at $0 per month and include $0 doctor visits and $0 generic prescription drugs. Visit medmutual.com/review or call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. MedMutual Advantage plans are HMO, HMO, POS, and PPO plans offered by Medical Mutual of Ohio with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in a MedMutual Advantage plan depends on contract renewal.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Blessed be the fruit. I'm Diana.
Oh my God, I've got to scroll up. And this is Lizzie. May the Lord open up, Lizzie.
And this is House Podcastica, Handmaid's Tale Edition.
Oh, this week we're discussing the first half of Margaret Atwood's book, The Handmaid's Tale.
And we're so excited. Oh my God, we've been waiting for this. When did we bring this up? We must have been like halfway through the season.
Yeah,
I brought this up as an idea of something to cover when the season was over.
Yeah.
And really thought about it and, just thought it would be a great thing to do. Interesting side note, before we even get into talking about the actual book, yes. I kind of played hooky from work today. I know this is recording, but they don't listen to this. I'm fine.
Well,
I have been wanting to sort of rewatch some of season one.
Really?
And well, in season one is pretty much the book.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to sort of compare, contrast, do some looks at it because I've never gone back and watched season one before. So,
oh my God. Yeah. It is such a treat, and it's a rich treat.
Yeah.
I went through and I watched the entire thing prior to season three.
Oh, really? Oh, I might have to do that the next time when season four rolls around. So at first I was watching like one episode here, there, and then finally I was like, I'm home and doing nothing. Let's just start from the beginning. So
yeah.
So I pretty much did that. And I, of course, when Hulu says, do you want to move on to the next episode? And it's the beginning of season two, you say yes.
Yes, you absolutely say yes. Yeah.
So I just thought it was interesting. So it's... obviously the book is fresh in my mind because I've been making notes and getting ready for this, but also the watching the show has helped like bring some more like themes and thoughts and ideas. So let's jump in with sort of quick thoughts, just like we do when we're talking about an episode. What are your initial thoughts on the book? Now, remind me, you've never read it before, correct?
I've never read it before, so this is my first time reading it.
Okay.
And I was reading it, like a chapter at a time for a while. Like, right after we started talking about the book club, I was like, I need to get that book.
Yeah.
So I'd read a little bit at a time, and I don't know. I'm not in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't not like it.
Okay.
I think I'm on the cusp of loving it.
Because I think we talked about this before when you were talking, you were struggling a little bit. And we talked a little bit because it's the writing style, like Margaret's writing style, just for not necessarily in general, because I've read some of her other things, but for this book in particular, the writing style is super different. And I've got that down on my list as like one of the things to talk about. So I think that can hinder it a little bit. If you're not ready for that style of writing and you're just like, it can be a little cumbersome.
It can be, but for the most part, I'm up for any style as long as it's, good, or the story is good. Sometimes it seems like you're either a good storyteller or you're a good writer. Okay. Very rarely it seems that you're both. And I'm somewhere in between. She may be both for me. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's what I did notice, because I think I was on page 179. I don't know. Maybe I was sleepwalking through it, because I was going back and I was trying to skim a bit and find some points. And I was just like, wow, I don't even remember reading this. Or, yeah. Wow, that is much deeper than I thought. So it feels like a book that I could see it being a literature book, you know, for class.
Right.
Where you go back and you're going back and you're reading and you know, rereading getting pieces together for your term paper and that sort of thing, where you're trying to figure it all out. So I could see it being something like that, because some of the things that I ended up pulling out, you know, because at first it was, you know, some, I don't know if it was weak stuff or it was just like, yeah, that'll do. But then when I was getting in deeper and trying to find things, some of the stuff circled back and I was like, whoa, I was like, huh, there's three instances of this. There's definitely a theme going on. And then this is much deeper than what I thought it was when I read it through. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like Moira's escape, I'm like, I don't even remember reading this.
Right. That's funny.
I read it.
Yeah. So I did. It didn't hit me.
Yeah.
So you're sort of, in terms of the book itself, and have you finished it yet?
No, I stopped moving forward when we set the date.
Okay.
And as of right now, I'm even backing up to reread some of the stuff before I finish it.
So since you haven't finished, you're on the fence, right?
Yeah, I don't not like it. And like I said, I'm on the cusp of loving it.
You're just waiting for that like breakthrough moment. I get
like maybe afterwards when I'm just thinking about it and I'm like, oh, you know, and when I read The Book Thief, the whole way through, I just felt like I was reading a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was just so well written and crafted, and it was just sheer genius. It was just so beautiful. And so beautiful that I cannot and will not read another book by that author, because I don't want to be disappointed.
Totally get it. Yeah.
And I feel bad.
Yeah. I've read a couple of other things by Margaret Atwood and they were good. But I think I was expecting Handmaid's Tale, which is wrong. I shouldn't have been doing that, but I was younger, you know, foolish. Yeah.
Our points of reference are so much smaller then.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? So I think my expectations were different. I wasn't let down. They were good books, but I've never gone back and read other books by her. Like I've reread Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
So on my end of it, I am trying to remember how old I was when I first read it. I was junior high or high school? I want to say high school, maybe.
Yeah, junior high seems so young.
I read books I shouldn't have when I was younger.
I'm not surprised. I was still reading Little House on the Prairie. It's like, let's go for another round.
Yeah, I like graduated to books that I shouldn't have really early. And the reason I even read it was my mom had it. She had a paperback of it. And I distinctly remember her having it with her when we went camping one time. If you look up the old artwork that used to be on the cover, it's on some of the trade paperbacks now. It's this drawing of the wall, and you just see two handmaids that are like walking away, and one is looking back. Now, you don't see anything on the wall. You're just like, as the reader, you know what's there, but you don't see anything. But the paperback my mom had was like the much smaller paperback, not those big, thicker trade paperbacks the way they are now.
Yeah.
And she had like the smaller version, and the front cover had like this flip out portion on the front cover so that the picture became bigger. Do you know what I mean? Like the cover folded out, like the actual cover. And then there were like all these different like quotes of like, you know, Atwood is a genius and blah, blah, blah. But I remember the look of the book. I remember it being with us, and I remember the picture intriguing me so much that I was like, I have to read this. So at some point, my mom put it back on the bookshelf, and I snagged it. And I was horrified and blown away, and it just affected me at such a guttural level. I loved it so much, and I had a tendency at that age to find these really great pieces of literature, and I would reread them over and over. So it's been a long time picking it up for the book club. It's probably been at least a good 15 years since I've read it. But back then I've read 20 times, maybe. Read the book. So, but it had been so long. And here's what's funny. I really thought that I had a copy of the book. So we're like, oh, you know, willy nilly, we're picking dates. And I'm like, I have a copy. I'll just grab it and whatever. Yeah. I don't have a copy of the book. It is not in the house. We've done a couple of book purges. And now, well, we sell or we donate or whatever. There's no such thing as throwing away. I'd kill myself if I'd throw a book away. It'd have to be super damaged.
Yeah.
But in that case, it's like, I don't want to look at it. Recycle it. But in all other cases, you know, library or Goodwill or whatever. So we've done a couple of purges, and I know we've done some paperbacks that were in kind of poor shape. And we have really nice bookshelves, and my wife was like, that looks really ratty, you know. So I know we've donated some, and I'm wondering if that's when it happened. I think I lost it during one of those purges. I know. Isn't that kind of funny?
Strange? But like the rattiness of a book sometimes.
It
should be. If it's not ratty, then what's wrong with the story?
Yeah, and then the pages open and it's easier to read. But hey.
Well, one's loved it. I mean, if someone saw my copy of The Stand, they'd be like, wow.
Never touched it?
Yeah.
Right. Here's the thing, though. That's a matrimony, like, you know, keeping the peace thing. I'm like, okay, we bought these beautiful bookshelves from IKEA. You want it to look nice. I get it. I'll succumb. So, you choose your battles.
Sacrifices.
But hey, I have a new version of the book, and it's a trade paperback now, and it's going to look lovely on my bookshelf now. I just thought that was hilarious that we got ourselves ready for it. And I thought I was prepared, and it turned out I was ill prepared. I took the liberty of looking back at what our last podcast was when we discussed Mayday, the season 3 finale. And you went first on the top 5, so I go first today.
That's totally fine with me.
Okay, so the first thing I wanted to talk about was, it's funny because it ties right into some stuff that we talked at length about when we were discussing season 3. When I refer to pages, I'm talking about the paperback version. There's also, side note, there's a graphic novel version that's out right now. I found it. I saw it on Amazon, but then I was at the store and I saw it at Target and I flipped it open and it is horrifying.
Is it really?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, if you're used to graphic novels in the Walking Dead sense where you're used to guts and gore and whatever, but this is a graphic novel in full color, and I like flipped it open and there's the ceremony and I'm like, whoa, shut the book. Nobody wants to see that. No.
Yeah, TMI.
I mean, part of me is intrigued just because I'd love to support a graphic novel, but I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm ready for that because we already see the images with the show. So
I know. And then, you know, that's funny because I was kind of thinking about something today, and I remember a couple of times, might have been Forrest Gump, and I bought the book or something that it was something that it was never a novel. And so the movie comes out and they release the novel or a novel. And really it's just the script doctored up to be a novel.
Right.
Now that's sort of what that graphic novel is saying to me.
Yeah. Oh yeah. They're like, we know what the visuals are and we're going to give them to you and we're going to paint them in there.
Going to terrify you at the same time.
It's a graphic novel. Anyway, so my point is that, so there's a couple of different versions out there. But I'm referring to the trade paperback version that I just got recently. So whenever I mention page numbers, I'm referring to that. So I kind of goofed when I was talking about page numbers for us for what to cover, because there's no page numbers in audiobooks. So,
yes.
I'll be more, I mean, it'll be a little easier for this one, because it's like where we stopped all the way to the end will be what we cover next. Yeah, but for this time, I had to like really scramble. I'm like, it's this, it's chapter something. And
it ends about here.
Page number doesn't work. Okay, anyway, so my number five, on page 112 of my copy, there's confirmation that the prenatal machines were outlawed. Because we had the whole debate about, when of Matthew was being held in that coma and the baby and all this other stuff, and they don't know if the baby's safe and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So directly from the book, I had to include this because it's great. It is, what will Of Warren give birth to? And Of Warren in the book is Janine.
Right.
So there you go. What will Of Warren give birth to? A baby, as we all hope, or something else, an unbaby with a pinhead or a snout like a dog's, or two bodies or a hole in its heart or no arms or webbed hands and feet. There's no telling. They could tell once with machines. But that is now outlawed. What would be the point of knowing anyway? You can't have them taken out. Whatever it is must be carried to term. Oh. So a lot of stuff to unpack from that, which is, I mean, as we thought in discussing the show, yes, it has been outlawed. So that's, that's canon. That's part of the book. So no neonatal machines, no prenatal machines, sorry. But also the idea that even if they knew that there was a defect with your baby, there's no aborting. There's no, you carry it to full term, no matter what it is. You give birth, and then from there it becomes something else. So I thought that passage was great, because it confirmed something that we were discussing not too long ago.
Right.
But it also created an extra level of horrifying for everybody.
Yeah, because then after the last episode, and I was actually thinking about how upset we were, and especially you, when the young girls got off the truck and...
with the... mentally handicapped,
Yeah. And I was just like, what do they do with a baby? Mm. You know, they were so willing to dispose of these people.
Right.
You know, what do they do with a baby? Like, are they just heartless about it? Have they hardened their hearts, the ones that actually have to do it? Do they still consider it a crime because they won't abort the baby?
Yeah.
So what are they going to do with it?
I know. It's so bizarre if you think about it, because it's like, if you're all about propagation of the species is your main focus now, it's all about procreation. It's all about furthering, God's will and all of that. Well, if God creates all creatures in his image, then wouldn't we want to keep those babies around? They may not look the way we're expecting them to. Maybe they've got defects and things wrong with them.
But it's God's image.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's interesting how I find in certain areas of this story, the book, the movie, the TV show, whatever, that it's sort of selective Christianity in a lot of ways, and we know that. We know that it's definitely selective. But this is definitely a big one. It's a big one. So, we insist that you carry your child to full term, that, abortion is outlawed, and we'll hang people who previously gave abortions or even were associated with someone who gave abortions. You will hang on the wall for that. But if a baby is born that's not quite up to snuff, we probably dispose of it. Like, there's no mention of what they do. It never says, not that I can see in the book so far.
On top of it, it's only her point of view or her experience. So unless she sees it, we don't know.
Right. So maybe we'll get some more information on that in book number two, when it comes out.
Later in, next season or something, since they have to do something.
Yeah, no kidding. They're going to have to start keeping all the babies because, you know, a whole bunch of them are in Canada now. So it's this one was...
We need to ramp up production.
Yeah, this one was born a little physically handicapped. And in the past, we might have done something to that. But maybe beggars can't be choosers now because we don't have as many children. So
that'd
be an interesting thing to see, you know. But that's my number five. I just wanted to, you know, we... confirm that the machines were outlawed. So that's all I got. So what's your number five?
Mine is Hard Work. And I don't know if I have a trade paperback or what, but this is towards the beginning, page 10. And Rita and Cora are in the kitchen and they're talking. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about Offred. And she's on the other side of the door kind of listening.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get early on, Rita is really kind of sour toward her. Mm-hmm. Cora seems more amenable, but basically Rita has no respect for Offred because she is a handmaid and she sees it as a choice that Offred made. And Cora's like, what kind of choice was it? I mean, you can go to the colonies and, you know, anything can happen, you know, with the unwomen, you starve to death and Lord knows what all, you know, and that's if you go to the colonies. And then Rita's just like, it was still a choice. And she's like, it's not what you would call hard work. Almost like she's copping out by being a handmaid. And I'm like, oh my God, Rita.
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of consider being raped hard work. And then, you know, the constant stress that goes along with, you know, your whole position because you're at the mercy of the wife, you know, and her moods. You're being subjugated by both the wife and the husband. You have to have sex with this husband, this man you don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, in order to survive it, you kind of check out and you basically just lose the bottom half of your body for as long as it takes him to do what he's got to do, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, I'm just like, it's not hard work. And it just struck me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I get it. It's not like it's Margaret Atwood saying, oh, that's not hard work.
No. You know what I mean? No.
It's just the opinion of this character and just not getting the gravity of the whole situation.
Yeah.
You know, like it's a choice to live. And, you know, at this point, it's page 10. You don't know much about Offred or not at all. And you don't know if she has a child, a husband, or, you know, any of that stuff. So you don't know what, you know, informed her decision. And
right.
Maybe it wasn't much of a decision. Maybe it was like, here you go. Here's your new dress. Let's go.
Yeah. It also does a good job of painting a picture in the very beginning of the book of how the rankings in the household, you know, sort of feel like, and how Rita feels about being in essence, Rita needs to be in service to Offred, you know, and she probably feels like Offred hasn't earned it, you know,
right.
Like the commander, you know, one would argue, you know, may have worked hard to get his position and works hard every day at his work and quote unquote earns Rita serving him.
Yeah.
But it's, and you know, you see Nick physically doing stuff all day. So you serve him, but all you see is this person who's in your way, who, you know, she does the shopping for you and that's great, but she doesn't do it the way I would do it. And, you know, so it's right off the bat before we get a full picture of Rita. It really shows her how she feels about the house and about like the whole circumstances, you know, you know, if she were given the choice, what would her choice have been?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Cause Cora says something like, you know, if I had been younger, I would probably have done it, you know? So, mm-hmm. So she, and I think she had her tubes tied. Yeah. She had her tubes tied and she's like, if I hadn't had my tubes tied and I was younger, I could be wearing red basically.
Yeah.
So, and that might've been the choice she made. It's kind of like in this world, no one job is going to definitely keep you alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody is, you know, yeah, everybody's, you know, I don't know. What's the word I'm looking for? They're all under his eye.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone is under the eye. Yeah, exactly.
They're all under the eye. So yeah.
Yeah. It's like a big rainbow or something that everybody's underneath.
Yeah, we're all God's children under his eye.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But that's all I have to say about that.
Okay, so then my number four then. I wanted to, we brought it up a little bit when we were talking about your initial thoughts, but I wanted to talk about the tone of the book, basically sort of the style of the writing, because it's different, you know, and that, like I said, that can be a stumbling block for people if they're not looking for it, but it's very documentary style.
Yeah.
And when you, I don't want to give anything away, but if you've never read the actual book, if you only watched the series, I don't want to give anything away, but there's a little bit of like an epilogue at the end that sort of explains some stuff that helps you see the book in a different way. But I don't want to give that away. But it is very documentary style. And not only that, but I feel like Margaret's plan in her execution was for you to feel the stillness of her job, of Alfred's job.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, in the TV show, you know, they can't get away with a lot of sitting around. There's always, right, she's going to a salvaging, she's going to a birthing, she's going to something, you know, it's ceremony night. There's always something going on. There's always some type of activity. But in the book, they make it clear that she does a lot of sitting around and waiting. She's basically a prop. And a lot of her time is spent, you know, recounting this tale, you know, telling this story, you know, Alfred from her point of view. She is descriptive. She's remembering items and remembering how she used to spend her day. She didn't just look out the window. She described the window. She described the feeling of the window, the sun on her face, and a lot of, and the curtain and how it falls and da da da. And she would go into such detail. And then I love how the writing would have her say something like, you know, for sake of argument, it's like, you know, white curtain, white gauze, and then like it would trigger a memory, and then she'd be off telling a story about, I remember a time when, you know, Hannah fell down and we had to put, I mean, I'm making that up, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of the style she used. She sometimes used the details of the room or wherever she was at, or whatever mundane task she had to sort of kneel and sit through and, you know, wait for it to be over. She'd be descriptive of things around her, and they would either inspire her to remember something. And then there were other times where she's like, I don't want to remember this. And it's so sad, because it's like, especially her memories of Hannah, you know, she just is like, this is really hard. And I think she says, you know, I just had this happen in the TV show, so I'm not sure if it happens in the book, but I'm pretty sure she also in the book has the moment where, you know, Hannah memories come back to her quicker when she's taking her bath.
Yeah.
Because she remembers giving Hannah her bath. So it just like, it like floods those memories to her. So I understand like the writing style that Margaret Atwood used, like we've said, it can be something that's difficult to attach to. It you literally have to almost sort of look at it less like reading a story and more like someone is telling you a story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think once you sort of get your brain adjusted to that and you just sort of let the words flow over you, then I think it hits you better. But again, sometimes all of those details, your brain doesn't absorb them all. So, you know, like you were saying, you went back and you were sort of skimming, looking for stuff, and you're like, oh, I didn't remember that happening that way. But I find,
or at all.
Right. But I find that happens sometimes when I'm remembering somebody told a story.
Yeah.
I'll remember it differently, because how you know, you and I could be sitting in a room with, you know, Elizabeth Moss as June, and she could be telling us all about her time as a handmaid. You are going to hear one story and I'm going to hear a different story. It's, you know, it's almost like that telephone game thing.
Yeah.
So what hits you in the details is going to hit me differently in the details.
Right.
So one of the things I've enjoyed in rereading the book over and over again is I do catch little nuggets that I'm like, oh man, that didn't hit me the first time through, or, you know, that one went right through me and I never even saw that description, you know? So it's not a style that I think everybody would enjoy, but I find it really interesting. It's super descriptive and it's different, you know, it helps it stand out, from other stories. So
right.
that's my two cents on Margaret Atwood and her writing style for The Handmaid's Tale. News at 11.
Yeah, there you go. It's funny because, not funny, haha, but just sometimes I don't think about what I'm reading in that mm-hmm. context. And yeah. I love when someone says something and I'm like, oh my God, you just opened up something for me.
Mm-hmm.
But this is definitely a book that I could go back and read and reread multiple times because there's so much richness in there. There's so much to discover every time you go through.
Right.
So I think it could be a book that would be heavily noted. Stickies and everything.
Yeah, exactly. I'm hoping when the second book, when it arrives next week, my mistake is that when I started rereading Handmaid's Tale, I didn't have like stuff with me. So like for the first like 20 or 30 pages, I didn't make any notes. And then I was at work and I was reading during my lunch break and I was like, I should write this down.
Yeah.
And I just opened up like the notes section on my phone. And to be fair, I just made a quick little note and I took a picture of the page. And that's how I took a lot of my notes, was I just, because I was usually like at work or I was on the fly or I'm sitting in my car waiting to, you know, start work or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was the method that worked best. But when I get the next book next week, it's right before we are going away on vacation. So I'm going to be, I'm going to have my, my post-it flags and my post-it notes with me.
And colored pencils.
Well, and I'm also not
highlighters.
Not sure I'll have the time to like read it twice.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure that if something hits me, I want to make note of it right away.
Yeah.
So that I can go back and review the stuff that hit me. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
I haven't even, I'm not even thinking about the other book yet because I've got to get through this one.
I hear you. And you have anything to add to my number four about the style?
Other than I'm going to look at it differently when I'm reading.
Good.
And then thinking, I'm so not worthy. How dare I even attempt to write? It would be a dream come true if I ever had something that someone was like, this is a piece of literature. And I'm like, really? I wrote that?
I don't
still expect time. It. There's still time. You never know. I just may not be old enough to write it yet. So
that's true. You just need some more life experience. That's all it is.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So that being said, then what is your number four?
I am going to go into stuff that I noticed, and this is probably going to be really brief, but if you think about our world now and how we have so much in it, and every day there always seems to be more, there's always some new craze and, you know, and then it just becomes rote and it's just a part of our lives, you know? And it's just thinking about the things that we're missing now from this society. Like, there's no lawyers. And why are there no lawyers? Because you can't have anyone challenging the government.
True.
You know?
Yeah.
No professors, no university. Right. Well, we'll give you on-the-job training if you're someone that needs to read. Or if not, you know, you're going to be a housewife or, you know, a baby factory. Right. what do you need to know?
What do you need words for? Yeah.
You know, because intellectuals are also dangerous. And I'm like, these are things that were banned from Nazi Germany that they got rid of, you know? And then I was like, when I saw the No University, I was just thinking about Emily and the guy that she worked with and, you know, how he was hung from school.
Yeah.
You know, and how shocking that is, you know? Ration stamps. It just all kind of reminded me of World War II, the things that everyone was going through.
Yeah.
A hierarchy, just where everyone fits in. You know, you've got your commander, the commander's wife. Then you've got the Econo wives. So the Econo people. And then Offred, the first time she enters the house, Aunt Lydia insists it's through the front door, and then every time after, it's only the use of the back door because she's considered a servant. Yeah. But Aunt Lydia wants them to be raised, you know, so that they are always using the front door. Mm-hmm. The wordless signs, it just is screaming to me how much they are dumbing down the society, and this is the extent. You cannot grow beyond this. And just that there's one way of thinking. So Baptists are bad. They're, you know, they believe in God, but Baptists are bad.
Right.
Quakers are bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody, but, and they, the thing is, they haven't even named what their religion is called.
Right.
But whatever it is, unless you are that, you are just a non-person.
Yeah, or you're just wrong. If you aren't this, you're wrong.
And dead, you know, pretty much.
Did we mention you'd be dead?
So this is a choice.
Right.
You know, otherwise you won't have hard work to do.
right, exactly.
It's as easy as you want it to be. just basically that. And, you know, of course I saw Blue Hills and the Baptists being smoked out of Blue Hills, but, you know, and I'm thinking Blue Hills, that's an exit off 24 and 128. Can't help it. Anyway, but yeah, that's just my small little one.
Okay. That's a cute little one.
Well, cute. Thank you.
Little.
Very cute.
Little. All right. Yeah. My number three is, it doesn't have to be a large one, but it's definitely, that's what she said.
She says it too often.
But it definitely bears some discussion. There are very many things that are exactly the same as the book, but there's one change that they made, and for the TV show, they did not make the change for the movie. It's actually a difference between Serena and Fred in the book, how they are described, and in the TV show.
Yeah.
In the book, they come off as definitely him. They come off as older. They're more like 40s or late 40s even.
Or I'm thinking 50s.
Yeah. He is described as gray or silver haired. And she's described as, like, her face is like, I think they described her face as puffy because it used to look a certain way when she used to be on TV. I don't really recommend it, but there was a movie that was made in 1990. And if you haven't seen it, I'm really sorry, but you might have to just for reference sake. But in that movie, the commander is played by Robert Duvall.
Ooh.
Right. And figure 1990, so this is like what, like 30 years ago?
Yeah.
35 years ago. So he's like 80 now, but he was like in his 50s when he did it. Early 60s. And his wife, Serena Joy, was Faye Dunaway.
Which makes sense.
Right. And she was very like dramatic and, you know, get out of here and get off me. The rest of the cast is a little bit better. Faye Dunaway is very like scenery chewy and whatever. Robert Duvall is pretty well cast because he's, you know, he's just a faithful worker. He seems very innocent in a lot of ways. The handmaid, Offred, is played by Natasha Richardson, Liam Neeson's wife, who passed away. And
I still can't believe that.
But I know. I still struggle. And yeah. Nick, which I think is interesting, was much more of a man. I feel like Nick on the show that Max Minghella, he's kind of smaller statured. So he feels young, like almost like a boy.
Yeah.
But Nick in the movie is Aidan Quinn. And he is hot in that movie.
Really?
I mean, the man. It just feels like, I think I'm just used to, like, and it might just have to do with how they cast Elizabeth Moss and Max Minghella, et cetera. Yeah. I mean, she immediately feels like a young girl, Elizabeth Moss, but a lot of that is also Yvonne Strahovski, who plays Serena, is tall. She's like model tall, and they don't put her in flats for this movie. So she certainly seems younger, because she's taller than a bunch of people. But I don't know, like, their choice for Nick, they made him younger as well. I don't know. Like, it's interesting. It's very interesting. But I think honestly that for the TV show, they made the selection of making Serena and Fred younger because I think it's less horrifying to watch someone younger doing the things that Fred had to do. It's horrifying, but I think there's like an extra level of, there's a difference between, I certainly don't want to go down this road because rape is rape is rape is rape, and it doesn't matter who does it. But I think in terms of making him a sympathetic character, there's also all of the levels that June has to play where she's flirting with him, and it has to be believable.
Right.
And is it more believable for her to be flirting with someone the age of Robert Duvall or someone the age of Joseph Fiennes?
Yeah. You know?
So, but in the book, he is strictly written as a much older guy. And I just really think that it's
a harder sell.
Yeah, and I think that it turns their relationship in the commander's study into more of a creepy older uncle kind of niece relationship, like father-daughter creepy, more than it makes them, it doesn't make them peers.
Right.
Casting Yvonne Strahovski and Joseph Fiennes makes them peers. They're the same age-ish level. And it puts them on a little bit more of an even footing, to say, like, you know, if this world wasn't existing right now, we might be colleagues. We might be, you know, whatever. But we're not because this world exists. And, you know, right now your husband is raping me. But, I think that it's really interesting that the TV show chose to make that. And I aesthetically, I understand why.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, do you feel,
I'm wondering,
for like a young woman, like Serena, or an older woman that doesn't have a baby? I don't know. And is it about
better?
What'd you say?
Who do you like better?
In terms of casting?
Yeah, which, do you like the older casting or the younger casting?
I don't know. I think that they both served a different kind of purpose. In the movie, it felt like this was like their last shot because they were older. They were a much older couple. Whereas it doesn't feel as desperate on the TV show because, I mean, yes, they're on their second handmaid. She's their second handmaid. But so there's that. But they're also a lot younger. So it feels like
they have more time.
Yeah. Even though, you know, she doesn't have as much to do with it, obviously. But, you know, and men can father children until they're, you know, in their 70s. Look at Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
But
or Tony Randall, much older.
God.
Way to go, Tony.
Visuals.
Yeah.
I think that each casting choice served their purpose in different ways in what they were trying to say.
Yeah. Whereas the movie was probably trying to stay more true to the book.
Yeah.
Versus that movie not doing so well.
Yes, true.
you know, looking at this and thinking, all right, what could we do to make this more interesting?
Yeah.
Like, if we're taking this and we're going to, like, what is our dream of dreams? Who would we do, and what do we want it to look like? I mean, I haven't bothered to look under the table to see, you know, who developed this, who, you know, is responsible for this whole thing. You know, it would be interesting to hear someone talk about how this all came to be. And because you get little snippets from week to week about what they were thinking about from one scene to the next, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But to find out what the creators were envisioning and why they were thinking that would be pretty interesting to me. Like, they took the source material, and then I would think, because of the age of the movie, that's still kind of source material now as well.
Yeah.
And what they wanted to do with that. When I look at an older couple like that, it feels a little antiquated that they would have pushed this new government into being. Mm-hmm. But when I think about a younger couple, and mostly everyone we see is in the same age bracket, that this is, it's like, oh, just wait, you know, these kids are going to be taking care of you someday. You know, that sort of thing. It makes sense. Their ages, the fact that they're younger makes sense, that they are trying to establish a new world order because the old one wasn't working for them. And, you know, to some extent, it's everyone's responsibility to try and do something like that. Mm-hmm. It even says it in the Constitution. If, you know, if it's not going the right way, so you are responsible for picking it up and bringing us back to the truth of the Constitution. That's just the way it is. And I can't remember the exact wording, but it, you know, that's essentially what it's saying. If government's not going the way that it was intended, it's incumbent upon you to fix it. That sometimes you have to rise up.
Yeah.
And I just think, although there could be someone much older at the ultimate top of this, it just seems to me to be a younger person's fight to do something like this. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the, Winslow there. I mean, still a very, you know, to be in your 40s like that, mid-40s, which that's about where most of them are, it just seems more vibrant. I just buy it more versus... If you're looking at all the commanders and their wives, and they're all 50 plus, that doesn't make sense. These people started this what do you call it? Movement.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't make sense to me, you know, because a lot of times by that point in your life, you've kind of like, all right, this is what it is. This is what I'm going to do. I'm cruising towards retirement.
Yeah. <You know? laughs>
You're pretty much done shaking the tree.
Yeah.
So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to double to make sure that we covered that it's different. It's a very different feel. It's a different, very different sense. I think it honestly, because I mean, it's probably because it's visual, but I feel like, Joseph Fiennes' Fred is much more creepy, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's very creepy.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like in the book, I feel like Fred is a lot more, and don't get me wrong, they're all wrong. They're doing the wrong stuff, but I just feel like he's a lot more naive. He's way more naive in the book than I think he's portrayed in the, you know, I think Joseph Fiennes is portraying Fred as kind of naive on the surface, but he knows what's going on. He's a smart guy. But I think he does the play naive thing as his flirt. That's his flirt technique, you know?
Yeah.
So, and he's just like so flirty and possessive of June, you know, and we see that as seasons you know, come and go, but right. Yeah, I just, I don't know. Yeah. It's an interesting shift. When you, if you've never read the book before, I'm curious to see what other people's, feedback will be as they are reading, when they get to the passages when he's being described and it's like, you know, gray hair and thinning and da 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 da. And if you hadn't read the book before, if you're you're only expecting like, wait, what?
Like, a full head of hair with a big what? Beard.
Right. He should have a full dark hair and the beard and the da da da, whatever. Yeah, but that's not what happens.
Yeah. All right. Totally different.
Yeah. All right. So Serena and Fred, differences for my number three. What's your number three?
My number three, I read a passage of this, one of the things on one of our podcasts, but I'm going to back up because this is one of the things that I saw as a theme. Mm-hmm. So the first time it went by me the first time.
Okay.
When I was doing my skimming and looking for my stuff, cause I was looking for this middle passage and on my copy, it's page 33 down the bottom, and it's at the end of a shopping trip with, I forget who she's with, but it's...
Of Glenn is her wife.
Of Glenn. Yeah. And they've just come from the wall. And it picks up, I feel a tremor in the woman beside me. Is she crying? In what way could it make her look good? I can't afford to know. My own hands are clenched, I know, tight around the handle of my basket. I won't give anything away. Ordinary, said Aunt Lydia, is what you are used to. This may not seem ordinary to you now, but after a time it will. It will become ordinary. And then fast forward a bit to page 56, where it says, is that how we lived then? And this was after a scene with Moira. And they're, you know, in her room smoking and stuff.
Yeah.
But we lived as usual. Everyone does most of the time. Whatever is going on is as usual. Even this is as usual now. We lived as usual by ignoring. Ignoring isn't the same as ignorance. You have to work at it. Nothing changes instantaneously. In a gradually heating bathtub, you'd be boiled to death before you knew it. There were stories in the newspapers, of course, corpses in the ditches or the woods, bludgeoned to death or mutilated, interfered with, as they used to say, but they were about other women, and the men who did such things were other men. None of them were men we knew. The newspaper stories were more like dreams to us, bad dreams dreamt by others. How awful, we would say, and they were, but they were awful without being believable. They were too melodramatic. They had a dimension that was not the dimension of our lives. We were the people who were not in the papers. We lived in the blank white spaces at the edge of the print. It gave us more freedom. We lived in the gaps between the stories. So she's talking about another ordinary, another usual. Mm-hmm. And all the way forward to page 133, and she says, Moira was like the elevator with open sides. This is when Moira gets away. Mm-hmm. She made us dizzy. Already we were losing the taste for freedom. Already we were finding these walls secure. So basically she's saying, this is the new usual.
Right.
You know, yeah. Moira didn't fit. We're becoming accustomed to this. Yep. They're getting their, the kidnap thing where you... I can't think of it. Of course, like 5 seconds ago, it was in my brain. But right. When you start to get that relationship with your kidnapper.
Oh, Stockholm Syndrome.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
So they're getting that. And I'm just like, that is interesting. Yeah. That, I mean, I know when I write, I often don't plan those things. They just happen. But it always makes me wonder about a real writer when they are putting this stuff together, and they go back and they add this little bit in, you know, kind of like a painting. Because when I look at it that way, I'm like, oh man, all these words. I don't know if I could do it. But it's stuff like that I really respect. And then I'm like, oh, maybe I do love this book, you know? It's just stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, Because I know for me, sometimes I get something from out of the ether and I must use it. And I don't know the purpose of it, and it just kind of hangs there. It's like a red ribbon on a bare tree branch. You know, okay. you can't miss it.
Right.
And it doesn't make any sense why it's there, and it's never touched upon. And then later on, much later on, you're like, oh, that's why that was there.
Yeah.
But I don't know that at the time.
Yeah, it reveals itself later.
Yeah. And so I'm like, does Atwood know that at the time? Or is it planned?
Or did it come out while she was writing?
Yeah, like, because it's, for me, I channel when I write. Most oftentimes I'm channeling, so I don't always know. I don't ask why. I just write it. And I wonder, you know, what her process is. Is it a bunch of, like, going back and forth and moving paragraphs around, you know? Mm-hmm. And I remember a writing class I took at the Muse in on Boylston Street. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. And the guy was working on a novel, and he was talking about how all the pages, he had printed out all the pages, and they were all spread out all over the floor, and he's like moving them around. And I'm like, oh my God, I just found that so overwhelming to have like 300 pages on the floor.
That you just have to organize.
Yeah. And it's like, they're all numbered and stuff, but like, if you pick up a page and move it from one location to the next, how are you changing your story? Sometimes you must.
Right.
But it would just, it freaks me out. It really does. It gives me anxiety, writer's anxiety, I guess. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So the moral of the story is, if I see you writing, like, don't mess with your pages, man.
Or don't ask me to move something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Don't move anything around. It's going to fuck you up.
I know. I mean, it's interesting now because I'm working on a project, and it's a film project. So it's not written, you know, and I'm just think it's weird. Like, I'm just like, oh my God, maybe this is how I should be writing my books. You know, it's really the stuff I'm like thinking about it and thinking about and how it comes about. It's just, it's fascinating. So I don't know. I know Margaret Atwood is doing some events, and I would like to go and see her.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know what she would be talking about, because I really haven't looked that deeply into it, but I'd be very interested to listen to her writing process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how she did that.
Yeah. That'd be
actually, it would be very interesting. Okay.
Yeah. All right. That's your number. Where are we? Number three.
Three.
So my number two.
Yeah.
All right. So my number two, I made a note of it, and then I wasn't sure if I was going to use it as a number, but then I was watching today and I realized, so in the TV show, they have the terrible implanted ear cuff thing.
Oh yeah.
As their identification.
Yeah.
And
is that electronic?
I don't remember. I just know it's one of those things where it's like you can't get rid of it. It's on there.
If you get rid of it, they'll give you another one.
Yeah, no kidding. As I was reading, I made note because it didn't hit me the first, you know, 30 times I've read the book or whatever, but it did this time around, because now I'm putting it against something visual. And in the book, they talk about she has an ankle tattoo. So very World War II, very concentration camps. And obviously the ear cuff is a similar thing. It's marking you, much like, I mean, even before they did tattoos, they were marking with patches. They were marking all the Jews in the ghetto, et cetera. So it's, you know, with a, you know, specific patch. So that it's sort of a similar in terms of like an identifier, but the tattoo, I'm pretty sure it was, it's like a barcode or something in the book. And I wrote it down in my notes as the ankle tattoo being equal to the ear cuff, because they don't have any tattoos in the show, but they do have that little cuff thing. So it's like, it's almost like they took that identifier, and it's a little easier to hide like the ear cuff because they're wearing the bonnet all the time, so you don't.
But I mean, the ear cuff and the tattoo on the ankle, both things are covered. So what's the point?
Are covered. Yeah.
You know, why not like pierce their nose or something where you can see it?
Yeah. Which is another thing. It didn't make it as a note, but it always, always, always has bothered me on the TV show. I don't, and I love so much about the visuals and the costuming and the pieces that they put everybody in. They do such a good job. But I don't understand the handmaids wearing the boots.
Yeah, it just never so serious.
That.
Yeah, they're like combat boots.
Right. In the book, they're wearing like, oh, it's almost like little Chinese slippers.
Yeah.
Which sort of lends it to...
Which makes more sense.
Right. It does make way more sense. I mean, if anything, give them like, you know, sneakers. I mean, they do a lot of walking for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, were they visually on the show trying to do something that made them seem more like a worker? Because the shoes, the little prim and proper shoes look very ladylike and dainty. And yeah. Maybe they just didn't think that that visual worked. Right. But I'm so used to the book, the description of the shoes are just like these small red, like little... you know, light little slippers or whatever. They even go so far as describing, like, once they hit summertime in the book, they're allowed to wear, they have like slits on the side so that air can get at their feet. They're not sandals per se, but they're just like regular flats that have like little slits cut into the side. But I just am like, I don't, it's the one choice that they've made on the TV show that just, it's so anachronistic to me. I cannot figure out where it slots in there.
Unless it has to go with them saying, if you didn't want us to be an army, you shouldn't have given us a uniform.
True,
and
true.
And their combat boots in that right. They're in the trenches, they're fighting. And maybe it was pointing to what was to come.
Yeah, and it does cover their ankles, which if they're going to be all prim and proper about that, you know, and they look kind of like manly and rough and
they're not attractive. Although I want them.
Yeah, I know they're obviously they must be comfortable. These gals do a lot of fucking walking. I'm saying.
I know. Well, it wouldn't even matter. Their feet don't matter.
So yeah. Anyway, I know their feet do not matter. Maybe that's what it is because their feet don't matter.
Yeah.
Like, because some of them are missing toes and things like that.
Or they've been whipped on the bottom of their feet.
And their feet have scar tissue and all of that. So I kind of got off topic there, but my number two, I wanted to talk about the different identifiers. So the ankle tattoo, the ear cuff that they use on the show, very interesting. So that's it for me. So what's your number two?
My number two is let's see. I'm gonna go here. I mean, it was kind of like because I didn't number them. I just have little blips. And it was kind of like, am I building towards something or not? But my number two has to do with the name stuff. Because we know a name is so important.
Yep.
It is something that, you know, identifies you to yourself, to others, and what you think of it and what other people think of it, the preconceived notions that come with it. You know, even today, you know, there was a guy here cutting down the tree that fell on the porch here. And he's like, oh, what's your name? And I'm like, Elizabeth. And he's like, wow, you don't hear that one anymore or that often anymore. It's like one of those old biblical names. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I do meet other Elizabeths and I do see the name and stuff like that. I wouldn't say it's that uncommon, but it might've been more from where he's from versus where I'm from. I'm not sure, but it got me thinking. And then when I came across this, it was, you know, at the beginning, in the first chapter, at the very end, it gives you the names. Right. Alma, Janine, Dolores, Moira, and June. And then, you know, they've talked since then about what Offred's name really is, and they tend to settle on it being June since it never comes up again in the entire book.
Yeah.
So then...
Yeah, I guess the theory is that people that have really studied the book,
yeah,
everyone who says their name, you know, from bed to bed in that first chapter or whatever,
yeah,
all of those women later are in conversation with the narrator.
Right.
And the only name that's never used again is June. So people did the process of elimination and have said June.
Yeah.
Margaret Atwood has come right out and said that it's not what she intended, but that it, so she didn't intend for you to probably ever even really know her name, but she's comfortable with what people have done and she's okay with the name June.
And so that tells me that she's an intuitive writer.
Yeah, so she was okay. It sort of like evolved.
Yeah.
But it was not her intention. Her intention was not to name her June. What's funny yeah. is before probably a lot of that was even out in the ether, you've got the movie, the terrible movie I just discussed a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
In that, she does name herself, and it's Kate. She doesn't name herself June at all. So it's interesting. Like, you can think of her as June or, you know, you could not.
She could be something else, yeah.
Yeah.
So on my page 84, it says, we wait, the clock in the hall ticks, Serena lights another cigarette. This is waiting for the
ceremony.
And then she flips right into a memory, just like you said.
Yep.
I get into the car. It's a Saturday morning. It's a September. It is, yeah, it's a September. We still have a car. Other people have had to sell theirs. My name isn't Offred. I have another name, which nobody uses now because it's forbidden. I tell myself it doesn't matter. Your name is like your telephone number, useful only to others. But what I tell myself is wrong. It does matter. I keep the knowledge of this name like something hidden, some treasure I'll come back to dig up one day. I think of this name as buried. This name has an aura around it, like an amulet, some charm that survived from an unimaginably distant past. I lie in my single bed at night with my eyes closed, and the name floats there behind my eyes, not quite within reach, shining in the dark. And I'm like, it struck me because my middle name is not common by any standards.
Okay.
And I've met other people with this name, but only one person with it spelling it the same way that I do.
Okay.
It does have, it kind of, because of that name, I ended up going to Elizabeth.
Okay.
And I have been every incantation of Elizabeth. And each one of them, and even my middle name, each one of them has a personality. And I think it's really strange, or it just strikes me because she's sitting there and she has to be somebody else.
Right.
The person she really is, she's buried deep.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just,
it does mean a lot. It does mean a lot. You know, your name, even if it's interesting how your name isn't, you didn't give yourself your own name.
Right.
Your name was given to you by others. And then it's sort of like, as you get older, it becomes what you want it to become. You know, you
get
nicknames and you define it, et cetera. And I it's funny that you said that about, like, you don't hear people with Elizabeth. Well, I have always struggled, make it sound like I have
emotionally struggled.
I never had the license plate for my trike when I was a kid, cause I spell my name differently.
You
so
do?
I spell Diana with two N's,
and
a lot more common now. But yeah. It wasn't when I was a kid.
Oh my God. When we were kids, it was very cookie cutter.
Yeah.
And that was the thing, because I grew up the first 14 years of my life, I went by my middle name. You will never find that written on anything.
Right.
my sister's, her name is spelled differently. So hers was never there. The only one that might have a chance was my brother. And there's two ways to spell his name. And of course, the other way is wrong. His way is right. But I mean, all three of us had these issues, you know, but at least their names were a little more mainstream. But I totally get it. I totally get it. Because like stuff like that would just destroy me. I would have loved to have had walk into Mammoth Mart or Bradley's or Zayers or Woolworths and find my name.
Yeah. I still can't. And I know, you know, names have, you know, back when, like you said, when we were younger and, you know, you'd go to a rest area for, you know, you're on a road trip with your family and, you know, they've got like little, you know, keychains and trinkets and they all have, you know, Anna, Alice, Amanda, you know, whatever. And they are all the like cookie cutter
kind
of white bready names.
Yeah.
And I'd never find mine. I mean, I'd find Diana, but it'd be spelled with one N, or it'd be Diane with an E at the end with two N's or something like that.
Yeah.
And now these days you see all, you know, like Michaela and, all these other names that you didn't hear a lot when you were younger, like really outside the box kind of names. And right. I still can't find my name anywhere on stuff. And it's, you know, and my name is misspelled all the time. It's said all the time. People see the two N's and I've been called Deanna in, you know, Deanne, or I mean, people look at it, they see the two N's and it's like they lose sight of the vowels at the beginning. And I've been called Donna. I'm like, you missed the two vowels at the beginning. Yeah. Not one of them was an O, but thanks.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, words have meaning, names have power. And it's interesting too that there's part of me that feels like she's not telling her name when she tells the story to sort of maintain some anonymity, but it's also to maintain sort of herself, because the story of her as a handmaiden has nothing to do with, you know, let's call her June. Yeah. It has nothing to do with her life as June. It's a completely separate part of her. And in order to keep herself sane, you know, she's got to be able to separate those two parts of her life. You know, June has Luke and Hannah. Alfred is someone totally different.
Yeah.
You know, so to not name herself when telling this tale, it does make a lot of sense, because it helps her keep that as something of her own that she doesn't end up having to sort of give away, you know, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I don't know, like, well, I suppose if she was recounting dialogue, then she might say her name as someone was speaking to her.
Right.
But other than that, this is just her running dialogue in her head.
True.
That we're hearing, that we're lucky enough to hear.
We are lucky enough.
So, yeah. All right.
All right.
So, your number one.
My number one. All right. So, my number one is almost to the halfway point. There's a nice section in chapter 23. In my version, it's page 134. But for those that might be in a different version, chapter 23. June pretty much admits, we just went through this whole thing. So, Alfred, she admits that her story, it could be wrong or misremembered in some spots. The whole chapter starts out with, this is a reconstruction. All of it is a reconstruction. It's a reconstruction
now in my head
as I lie flat on my single, I took a picture of the page and I'm
curved.
I'm like, in my head, as I lie flat on my single bed, rehearsing what I should or shouldn't have said and what I should, or shouldn't have done, how I should have played it if I ever get out of here. She says, when I get out of here, if I'm ever able to set this town in any form, even in the form of one voice to another, it will be a reconstruction then too, at yet another remove. It's impossible to say a thing exactly the way it was, because what you say can never be exact. You always have to leave something out. There are too many parts, sides, cross currents, nuances, too many gestures, which could mean this or that, too many shapes, which can never be fully described, too many flavors in the air, too many flavors in the air or on the tongue, half colors, too many. It's just interesting that she is telling the story, but also telling you at the time that, you know, this may not be completely true. This is as much as I can remember of what happened to me and how this happened. And I can't, you know, I don't know if it, you know, there may be parts I'm forgetting or misremembering or leaving out or whatever. So it's just interesting to get like the admission of, you know, you're full by this point of the book, you know, you're 134 pages in, you're fully entrenched in this tale. And then she comes back and is like, by the way, I might not be remembering this correctly. I might be telling this story later on down the road and you may be hearing it or reading it or whatever. And I can't guarantee that it's 100%, you know, but it's true to what I think I remember. Mm-hmm. So I think it's nice because it's a bit of honesty that, you know.
Well, you know, another side of that could be that the indoctrination that goes along with what's usual and what's ordinary. Mm-hmm. The way she tells it may change by how she now thinks. So the things, like as far as the nuances that, you know, she may miss because they're no longer bizarre.
Yeah.
It's accepted and it's normal. So she might leave some of that stuff out.
Right. Right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So that's my number one. Be aware that the story that we are reading might not be 100% correct. So,
yeah. And actually our books are numbered the same. That's my 134 as well.
Good.
Yeah. Okay.
So what's your number one?
My number one has to do with the doctor's visit.
Ooh. And
I think that, and not that I was building up to this, I don't even know that any of these weigh more than the other. But the doctor's visit, and you know, we saw the monthly visits with the young girls while June was, you know, doing penance in the hospital.
Right.
You know, with the handmaid there. And she has to go month to month and they'll detect at that time whether or not she's pregnant. But, you know, she's also concerned that the doctor could say she has cancer now and it would just take her completely out of the game.
Right.
You know, she talks about how much power that this man has. And the thing that kind of gets me is I think he may be playing with fire and may end up on the wall, maybe like the other doctors that she comes across. But he says to her, I can help you. And the thing that kind of bothers me is that while he's talking to her, he's telling her what her situation is and he never takes his hands off of her.
Yeah.
And that really bothers me because like when she talks about her breasts being touched in turn because he's examining her and I was reading that and I'm like, what if he's enjoying it? Cause she can't see him, you know,
right.
Like they put the sheet in front of her so that they can't see each other. So she has to trust that whatever he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. And the thing that got me was that, you know, she talks about him touching her. His hand is on her the entire time when he's saying, you know, I can help you, you know, and he calls her honey. And I'm like, this is creepy, you know, and he's talking about her being soft right now, that this would be the time to do it and that he's helped others. So it's kind of like he's, you know, backing her into in a corner, like, you know, everybody else has jumped off the building. Why don't you do it too? And, you know, she doesn't know if he is doing it to trap her or if he's doing it to help her, you know, cause it could be either way,
mm-hmm.
but she doesn't know if she says yes. Next thing you know, she's on her way to the colonies, you know, like this is part of his job. And I mean, if she says yes, sorry, but if she says no, then she may be getting rid of an ally she needs later. So she's just kind of like takes it and she's like, thanks for the info, you know, but he was such a predator that entire time, you know, and he's got one right after the other coming in day after day after day.
Yeah. So how many has he made that? You know,
overture.
And how many have said yes? So how many babies are really doctor babies?
Yeah. And or does he even know if he is viable?
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't say I'm definitely viable, you know, because he doesn't, it definitely makes him a predator.
Yeah. But,
you know, he does say, you know, all the men, you know, they can't do anything. They're sterile, but they blame it on the women.
Yeah.
But it does say that. But yeah, so that's my number one.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Well, thanks.
Nice. Do you have any notes? Any things that you didn't cover? I gotta, let me see. What am I look through? I got a couple of things. Nothing major.
I mean, yeah.
You want me to do my notes first, or you?
Yeah, because I just have one. You go ahead.
Oh, okay. I think it's funny that I wrote down a version, a part of. I think you brought up in one of your numbers, and I wrote it down as a note. I put ignoring isn't the same as ignorance. You have to work at it.
Right.
I think you included that in part of one of your things that you said.
Yeah.
I put in June does confirm. Somewhere like toward the start of the book that Hannah's around 8 when the book begins, which tracks with the TV show. I wasn't aware, but I hadn't watched season 1 again. And she does have a moment where she says that she'd be about 8 when she's talking with Uvglen, because Uvglen's talking about Oliver would be about 5.
Right.
So they kept that. The one thing they don't do on the show that I thought is interesting was the whole thing where they use butter for their skin to keep it moist so they don't get dry skin. Mm-hmm. So there's that. I called it the butter ceremony.
Yeah.
Definitely. I thought it was interesting. There's a whole passage where she says, where she actually, Offred, won't call the ceremony rape. Because he basically is like, I signed up for this. And I don't know if that's really her, or if that's like people like Rita, or people who have that sort of like, you know, they knew what they were doing. They knew what they were signing up for, like that kind of influence. It is still rape. I wonder if she just can't call it that because she's got to compartmentalize it in her mind. Yeah. You know, like in the scenes we saw recently, she's got to, you know, turn your mind off, pretend it's not happening, float away, go someplace else. And part of that to her might be, I can't call this rape. Not right now.
Yeah. It's survival. It is. How she has to get through it. So
yeah, there was another note that I thought was really, this will be my last one. When they are at the birth for Janine, for Of Warren, and the handmaids are there supporting her and everything's done and over with, there's this really great line, which I thought was interesting considering in the book, we don't really know Janine's outcome, at least not so far. I haven't finished my reread as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the TV show delves more into some Janine stuff, but I thought that this was interesting. Post her having the baby, it says she'll be allowed to nurse the baby for a few months. They believe in mother's milk. After that, she'll be transferred to see if she can do it again with someone else who needs a turn. But she'll never be sent to the colonies. She'll never be declared unwoman. That is her reward. Huh. And I thought that was interesting because it's literally everything that happens to Janine on the TV show. Now, granted, it's like, you know, they are going beyond the book, and so who knows? But I just think it's interesting because that's supposed to be the reward. The reward for actually bearing the child is if you can just like stiff upper lip it, then you won't ever be sent to the colonies. At least that's what the intent in the book was.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that it feels that way on the TV show. It feels like, you know, you're just going to be a baby making machine until we retire you. And our method of retiring will be like, okay, you're all done. Okay. We're going to send you to the colonies.
Cause I mean, what's your real purpose?
Yeah, but at least in the book, and I'm, you know, it's kind of an equivocation, you know, but it's like, there's at least like a measure of respect that's given.
Yeah.
You know, you did this thing and we admit, you know, it's pretty huge. So we're never going to send you to this awful place because of it. You know, you earned a good retirement, you know, and it doesn't say like, maybe she ends up being a Martha. Maybe you end up, you know, that's you, once you can't bear children anymore, maybe you're a Martha or some type of,
you'd have to be useful
domestic servant, but you still have to, you know, be in service too. So but I just thought that was great. It didn't hit me the first few times I read the book, but now with such a larger Janine sort of story that we've been given over these two more seasons that we've had, it's just interesting to have more than that. So what were your notes?
I just have one, and it's really when she finds out Moira is there in the Red Center with her.
At the Red Center. Yeah.
And what a consolation that is for her to have something, someone so familiar to her, like a friend. And it just made me kind of happy, I guess, you know, wanting something, like I would want something like that, a touchstone of some sort to the past, you know?
Yeah.
And just relief that that person's alive. And that's it. And I'm ready for break.
That's it. That's all you got. I'm ready for a break too. I bet our listeners are ready for a break. So that being said, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break. We will be right back in just a minute. We're back. This is our first time in the commander's study.
Yeah, so, I took all this time.
Yeah, I know. So we thought that something weird was going to happen when he asked to come down here, but turns out all he really wanted to do was play Scrabble and read some letters from the front. So here is one of them, which is a great article on Margaret Atwood that I found in The Guardian from, and it's difficult because since she's got the new book.
The Guardian.
Yeah. Since she's got the new book coming out, I know that's pretty funny. It's hard to find like kind of older articles that are just her talking about the first book. There are so many, like advanced copies are out. So it's all interviews talking about the new book because it comes out next week. So it was really, really difficult. I had to paw around, but this is an older article. It's from January of 2018. The title of it is Margaret Atwood. I am not a prophet. Science fiction is really about now. And I just pulled really one quote that really stood out to me from the beginning, right at the beginning of the article. And she says, and I quote, again, I'm not a prophet. She says, let's get rid of that idea right now. Prophecies are really about now. In science fiction, it's always about now. What else could it be about? There is no future. There are many possibilities, but we do not know which one we are going to have. She is, however, quote, sorry to have been so right.
Oh, God.
And it's a really great interview with her. She talks a lot about, you know, obviously the book, but also the impact of the show. This article was released before season two came out. And she talks a little bit about her involvement with season one and that she wasn't as involved because she has a little tiny cameo in season one, if you weren't aware. And she's not doing any of that for season two or anything else moving forward. She's mostly just going to be on set for season two for as like a, you know, consultant, et cetera.
So
it's a really good article. I will have a link in the show notes for you. And next up we have the Martha Network, which we have to start at square one again this time around because, you know, we're new here and Rita doesn't even trust us yet, let alone like us. So we've only got a little bit of feedback for this time around, but just like a stolen pat of butter, we'll take it.
Yes.
So on Facebook, we got a comment from Lara Soggle, who says, made it to the halfway point, just short of the 6-hour mark in the audiobook. And in a couple of days, it's a different story from the inside of June's head only. Correct. In comparison to the show, it leaves you in a bubble of world building. They also changed Serena Joy for the show, which I'm also torn about.
Yeah.
We talked about in the book she is more actual like kind of ministry. She was part of a she appeared on like Sunday mornings and did a lot of like singing and preaching. She was more like actual ministry as opposed to in the TV show Serena does the she was the it feels like she was kind of like an educator, you know. Yeah. What I mean, she yeah. wrote books and she spoke on the topic of, you know, traditional values and all that other shit. So so there's that. Then next up, we also had one voicemail from our pal Mayday Rennie. So let's go right ahead and listen to that.
Hello. I am so glad that you're doing this book club. So I have two observations and a book recommendation. First, I read this book shortly after it was first published when I was in graduate school. What struck me then, and still does all these years later, is that were I put into the handmaid situation, I would have just plain died of boredom. She describes how she explored the room, dividing it into sections and exploring one section a day to make the exploration last. Wow, what a description of boredom. Some of the language describing boredom is excruciatingly beautiful, such as, quote, "This is one of the things I wasn't prepared for, the amount of unfilled time, the long parentheses of nothing, time as white as sound," end quote. Yeah, for me, to have reading and writing taken away from me would be the worst form of torture. My next observation is about the character Serena Joy. This sentence about what she was doing in the time before Gilead, advocating that women stay home, quote, "Serena Joy didn't do this herself. She made speeches instead, but she presented this failure as a sacrifice she was making for the good of all," end quote, reminds me of Phyllis Schlafly, who had a law degree and who campaigned vigorously against the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s, advocating that women stay home. I have to think that Schlafly served as one model for Serena Joy. The best thing anyone ever said about Schlafly, in my not at all humble opinion, was said by Karen DeCrow, president of the National Organization for Women. Quote, "If I ever had a daughter, I'd want her to grow up to be a housewife just like Phyllis Schlafly," end quote. Atwood shows what happens to someone who advocates against her own freedom, writing about Serena Joy, quote, "She doesn't make speeches anymore. She has become speechless. How furious she must be now that she's been taken at her word," end quote. And finally, Atwood has said that everything that happens in the book has happened in some place at some time. And the 1979 revolution in Iran is one of those times and places. So I want to recommend to book club members interested in going deeper into the background and influences another really great book called Reading Lolita in Tehran by Azar Nafisi, who participated in the revolution to overthrow the Shah as a member of a progressive political party, and then saw her egalitarian revolution morph into the gender repression of Iran under the Ayatollah. She writes very eloquently about that in Reading Lolita in Tehran. So thanks again for the book club.
Thanks again, Rennie. Lots of great information there. And you know, I never read Reading Lolita in Tehran, but I have seen it recommended before. It looks like a really, really, really interesting book. So maybe once I'm finished with Testaments, we'll have to take a stab at that and maybe get a conversation going on the Facebook page about, you know, where Atwood may have gotten some influence from there, et cetera. So very interesting. Good stuff. Very good stuff. So next up, I would say that let's discuss that we're probably going to discuss the second half in about 2 weeks. We haven't really centered on a day yet to record the podcast, but it'll be in about 2 weeks from now, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we want to make sure we tried our best to do this sort of spreading out, so that people have time, because I know life gets in the way. Some people read faster than others, but you know, we wanted to make sure to allow for enough time. And if you did want to give your opinions and you see that we're getting close to, you know, 2 weeks and maybe you haven't finished the book, you know, reach out to us, you know, maybe we can extend that deadline. Who knows? We certainly want to make sure that everybody is able to talk about the book and give more feedback. So we're hoping for some more overall feedback on the Facebook page when we get to the end. I'm wondering if there were just some people just didn't quite get finished to the halfway point in time, but we do love the pieces of feedback we did receive. And once we start reading testaments, then we will get more of a sense of when we will be podcasting on those two as well. So once we know, you will know. And that is our show. So thank you so much for listening in this week. If you want to join us in the discussion of the books, you can do so in the following way.
If you'd like to write in or record a message and send it in, you can email us at dragons@podcastica.com. Oh my God, I did it right. We also have our webpage where you can submit feedback as well at housepodcastica.com.
You can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/housepodcastica. We're also on Twitter and on Instagram. You can find us both there under the name @housepodcastica. See, I mess it up too.
I don't know why. I mean, it's pretty simple. Podcastica.
I know, right?
Yeah. I can say it fast. Podcastica. But try to read it. I'm like, I can't do it. And be sure to check out the other great podcasts at Podcastica. I did it.
There you go. Special thanks also to Laura Willie Swink. She created the new House Podcastica artwork. That's very Handmaid's Tale inspired. She also just redid the artwork for Brian Maloche's Picard podcast, and it looks wonderful. Great job, Laura. And also special thanks to Ben Beck for the website design. So thanks so much.
Awesome. So if you want to find me elsewhere, you can listen to my other podcast on the Walking Dead franchise. Right now we're doing Fear the Walking Dead. It is Brains Gone Bad at, the podcast. You can find it on any place that you find podcasts. Mm-hmm. You can find me on Twitter at Brains Gone Bad. And then I just released my 9th issue of Lizzie's Lost Girls. It's called Audacity of Hope. So it's a serial. So, yeah, I'm ramping up towards my next digest. So one more episode one more issue for that. So right now, I don't even know if it'll still be running, but you can get the second and third issue for free. Just Google Lizzie's Lost Girls on Amazon and you'll find them.
Nice.
Yes.
You can also check out my other podcast, Aim for the Head. We also cover the Walking Dead universe, strangely enough. We're at facebook.com/aimfortheheadpodcast, easy to find. And we're also over on Twitter at AFTH Podcast. We're on Instagram as Aim for the Head Podcast, all one word.
Dude, if we weren't podcasting about the same show, we wouldn't even know each other.
I know. That's pretty sad. So I mean, I'm glad that we podcast.
I know, it's because I was out spying and I'm like, who's around us in these rankings? And I was like, oh my God, their podcast is gonna, it just blows ours out of the water.
Oh, stop it.
Oh, it really does. Oh, so yeah,
we have a lot of fun. We enjoy ourselves.
Yes. Yes, yeah. We do. So
this podcast as well. And
yeah, we do.
We have to say that the war is going well, I hear.
Praise be.
And we've been sent good weather.
Which I receive with joy. Serena joy.
Blessed be the fight, Wendy Ott Eppers.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. so you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio seniors, it's time to make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Plans start at $0 per month and include $0 doctor visits and $0 generic prescription drugs. Visit MedMutual.com/review or call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. MedMutual Advantage plans are HMO, HMO, POS, and PPO plans offered by Medical Mutual of Ohio with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in a MedMutual Advantage plan depends on contract renewal.